You are listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, episode 290, Pure Software Cameras and the End of the Classic NES.
Season 7, episode 290 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is Easter, April the 16th, 2017. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and my furiously fast brother is James Furlough.
Hey, yeah, man. Happy Easter. Super exciting. I was kind of half wondering if you were going to do a, and my brother being dragged into this podcast, kicking and screaming. Maybe that's too soon.
No, I had so many options to go with because we've got Star Wars Celebration going on right now.
Oh my gosh, Star Wars! Yes,
Star Wars. Give me
it's time
Star
for the Jedi
Wars.
To end. I'm really hoping that's like cut off in the middle of a sentence, but probably not.
To end, not eating since lunch. It's time for dinner.
What was it? The theory I've heard, which I can get behind the most, is he's as part of his hero cycle. He's kind of like given up, and that's maybe the beginning part of the movie. And somehow he needs to be shown that no, it's not. But I don't know.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see what direction they go. But I guarantee you the one thing he's not doing is I'm giving into the dark side of the force that people are predicting. Like,
what?
No. It's the end of what? Okay, there's two ways. You're right. You either he's given up and she's going to help restore his optimism, or what he's saying is, no, we have a harder thing to do. The Jedi didn't have it right. There's this deeper idea, and the Jedi were systemically, it was a systemically destructive culture that led to inevitably to Darth Vader. And that's the problem.
That's deep.
And I don't want to get too into predicting exactly what will happen, but yeah, that's probably the direction we'll go. But I'll be honest with you, James. Amongst my options for today's intro, could have talked about Warriors basketball, man. They killed it today. First game. Woo! Excited.
Good job.
But I went with Fast and the Furious.
What do you think? It's going to be Cavs Warriors finals for like third year in a row, right?
I hope not. I hope the Cavs lose before that. Not because we couldn't beat them, and not because it wouldn't be fun to watch them get beat again, but because I want James to go down that hard.
Gotcha.
I want him to not even get to the finals. But I decided to go with the Furiously Fast and the Furious, because I had never seen a Fast and Furious movie.
Really?
Before this week. Yeah. I had completely missed
it. What was
the
first one you saw?
So I have no,
because the first one is on Netflix, for the record.
I have no idea what the deal is with this, like with this series. Like I didn't understand at all. I never paid attention. To me, it was just like it's a car movie. I didn't know anything about it. Like, I didn't know that the main character was a cop. Like, that's how like disengaged I was from this series. So the fact that they're like working with the government, going on like superhero missions, I was very confused by it. And my curiosity had finally peaked. And so Apple was selling the 7-pack for $40 this week. I'm now 4 Fast and Furious movies in. My goal.
I hear number 3 is horrible. Is that true?
You know, honestly, it's dude. So far,
Tokyo Drift, right?
So far, they've all been real bad in the way that like bad movies are bad, but like kind of fun in the whole like knowing that they're really bad going in. You're like, oh, this isn't so bad. People are going above and beyond it, like criticize. Like they're just. It is the quality of a pretty good TV episode. Not a great TV show, not a particularly bad TV show. There's sort of your middling. There's some funny parts. There's some exciting parts. There's some, like, just don't try to make sense of it too much, and you'll be fine. And, But the part that was really getting to me is, like, if you don't know that this was done completely by accident, watching them back to back to back, it's almost like they were doing it on purpose the whole time. And like, and there's like, there's this sort of like symphony of coincidence that's going on right now to like build up this series. And I kind of like it, James. I kind of like it.
Okay. Okay. I, on the other hand, have started watching Cheers, because last week I had two separate people in two separate incidences reference it, and I was like, clearly this is a pop culture thing that I'm not in on. I need to catch up here.
Man.
And you know what? I'm glad I have. It's pretty funny.
I believe it. How many episodes are there in Cheers?
I don't know. I chose not to look, but I've got to admit, it's got to be one of those like 15 season types of things.
Yeah.
It's probably went like 7, but I mean, it's classic. They're just in a bar. They don't do anything. It's just talking, but they got some pretty good tropes. And
when we went to Boston, it's amazing how many people were like, and you can go to the Cheers bar. And I, having watched maybe an episode of a half of like cumulative time wise worth of Cheers, I was like, yeah. The Cheers bar. Like, am I supposed to care about this? But I bet if I actually sat down and watched it, I'd be like, oh my god,
it's pretty funny. I'm trying to think. It's not like, I'm trying to think what it's like. I mean, it's an older school one where each episode kind of can sit on its own. You know, it doesn't. It's not like. I will finish my thought here. I want to liken it to How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
But, like, pretend it happened kind of in the 80s, and it doesn't quite have the same thread all the way through.
Right.
You know, maybe like Friends, but it's not, it's better than that, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah. You're just a...
They're into their puns, too. That's like, and I think that's why I appreciate it. Like, you know, like the comedy on the movie The Airplane?
Yes. Airplane?
You know, where it's like someone will say something and they'll answer them. And you're like, yeah, okay, technically right, but that's not what I meant.
Yeah.
You know, like one of them, like one of the main girl, her name is Diane. She goes, well, call me weird. And people are like, you're weird. She goes, okay.
I think my theory is you're just a Dr. Fraser Crane fan.
Oh,
is
yeah.
Is that the truth thread for the whole thing?
I do. I do appreciate his, well, his like, well, and eventually like with his, that's the problem with watching these things back to back. Like his is eventually the pattern of the episode became abundantly clear.
Right.
And it was like, it took them like two seasons to figure it out. But then once they found it, they just did it over and over and over and over again, which for him, it was some situation arises. He gets an opportunity of sorts. And then he has some sort of misunderstanding and totally messes it up. And then partway through recognizes the fact that he did it wrong and chooses to cover it up instead of coming clean.
Yeah.
But fails in the cover up and eventually gets caught and, you know,
so is this,
gets in trouble.
I can't tell if you're talking about Cheers or Frasier.
That's Frasier.
Okay.
No, right. Cheers is, it's a different type of humor.
Right.
But it's, like I said, it's more of the one-liner zingers. It's funny. I don't know. Watch a couple episodes. You'll enjoy it. It's good.
All right. I like it.
I find myself, like, audibly laughing out loud multiple times. I'm like, oh, dude, that's
I'm sure. Funny. Well, it was a stellar cast of comedians. But, yeah, I like it. You know what, James, though? We're not here to talk about all of those things. This week, like every week, we're going to be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, Jim's got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
I founded and work for HPI, but do not represent HPI or any of their opinions. I also own part of Twitter, which, by the way, I did a proxy vote this week for the thing, which, interestingly enough, I got to vote with my singular share on whether or not the directors should do the research and put together a proposal for Twitter to become a community-owned company. So, in other words, no longer become public, but instead the owners are the users. And so if you have a Twitter handle, you can own part of Twitter. So kind of like REI, it's employee owned, or Bi-Mart, or I think even Winco technically is employee owned. And so those are just some examples of employee owned, but think of it as user owned, if you will. Huh. And the idea being there's a community good there. That way they don't have to try to chase profits and things like that. It almost becomes a non-profit, right?
That would be really nice for Twitter to not have to chase those pesky profits anymore.
Those dollars become more of a non-profit.
Who wants to do that?
I know. So the proposal was for the direct, and this was a shareholder proposal that was put out there. And so it would be essentially for the board of directors to put together a proposal, which then the shareholders would vote on. So it was kind of a proposal to make a proposal, if you will. And the directors had it was kind of interesting. They had the pro, and then they had the con, and the directors gave the con. Like, look, we haven't like done a ton of due diligence, but we've looked into this, and we always have the best for Twitter on the lookout. And we've done a lot of things, and this would just be a massive distraction, and so we don't want to do it. So I ultimately voted no, even though I thought it would be a great, awesome experiment.
Yeah.
I also own part of Twitsy, yes. Etsy and Lending Club. I didn't do any active voting for those guys.
Yeah. Nice. I like it. My disclosure is that sometimes I apply to companies like Google. I don't get hired. I just apply.
Got to start somewhere.
It's true. Actually, I had a friend of mine who works there personally recommend me. They have like an internal form and stuff.
Yeah, means, I got an interview with one of those.
Which means that I will definitely have my resume looked at and be like, yeah, probably not.
You never know. You never know.
We'll see what happens. Prepare for the worst. Anyways, yeah, if you want to follow us with the week, we're on the social media. We do stuff like Twitter at Matthew D. Furlow. Oh yeah, is mine. Also, Instagram, which is blowing it up. There next week in four is the place to check that out.
James Furlow everywhere. Twitter.com, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook. I think that's pretty much all I use at this moment.
So we're not doing this story, which is my way of throwing in a story without having to take up time doing it. But yeah, Instagram stories are now have more views than like more user engagement than all of Snapchat.
Wow.
Right. That's a successful ripoff product. That's pretty
good. We're
gonna
make fun of Facebook at the very end of the show though.
Yes. But yeah, if you want to get more information on this week's news, like if you want to get all the articles that we talk about, not the Snapchat story one, because technically didn't talk about it, you can go to furlowbros.com and all the clicks, links, articles, videos, audio, anything we talk about will be there for you to check out. Take a look-see.
But first, let's talk about things you should not check out.
All right.
Lifehacker had a really – no, I'm sorry. Gizmodo. Same company, had a really good snarky article that was titled 15 Idiotic Internet of Things Devices Nobody Asked For. And I felt bad for a couple of these because I may have asked for them. But anyways, I thought it'd be fun to go through and like, here's what these are real products. Okay. So,
all right, give it to
if
me.
You're into it, here you go. The first one is Trax. With a Z.
Cool. Very cool.
Think of it as Fitbit for your dog.
Oh, man.
It will tell you somehow how much your pet is eating, not how much your dog is walking around. I don't know how that works. But apparently, you know, if you think Fido is kind of sneaking off and grabbing a snack,
yeah, that's
you
weird.
Can find out. I appreciate this
I'll
one.
I bet it doesn't work that well.
Yeah, that might be true. I could have gotten behind a Fitbit for dogs. Like, that would be interesting. It's my dog exercising.
It's got a GPS tracker, which, yeah, I guess. I can see why that one's kind of dumb. That one, really, like, that one feels like at the edge of an almost good idea. Not a great idea, but it's...
I could see a health tracker for your pet. Like, I could see people get behind that.
I think a tracker for your pet is something that is sellable. But it's like, if it doesn't tell me where my pet is until my pet gets back, and then it tells me where it was, haven't really helped the situation.
Yeah, true. Very true. Yeah, very true. This next one is called Hydrate Spark. Okay, I love this one.
Cool.
It is a smart water bottle that glows. This is what how they. This is how they say it. That glows to make sure that you never forget to drink your water again. Which, again, the snarky comment is, apparently the concept of drinking water when you're thirsty is unfashionable now. So I'm like, hey, technically, if you wait until you're thirsty, it's too late, but whatever.
Does it tell you how much water you drank, or does it just...
He doesn't say. Maybe. I mean, that might be nice. This next one is the... this one's just kind of crazy. It's I can't even pronounce it. It's the Crostacy Hair Coach. It is a smart hairbrush that uses a gyroscope, an accelerometer, and a microphone to listen to your hair to see if you're brushing it all wrong. It's you a, sloppy moron.
Yeah, that's right.
Like I feel like a mirror.
I'm gonna say that feels like a solved problem, but
a mirror solved. Yeah. Or this one. I love this one. Egg Minder. It's an egg tray for your fridge to tell you how many eggs you have left and even how fresh your eggs are. Which, the, again, snarky article, massively superseding the old technology of, quote, looking at the date on the box.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, again, that seems like the sort of thing that, like, is on the edge of an okay idea. It's not really, it doesn't actually get you all the way to a... Hey, that's an okay idea. I could see justifying that. Like, you know, something that keeps track of the date of everything in your refrigerator and how long it's been there. That's a that isn't okay. Even the full idea, but at least it's like I could get behind that to some degree.
Yeah, it would be nice. Yeah, if it could somehow, when you put something in, it tracks it. It's like, oh, this is a new thing. And then you could, it could... You know, maybe sends you an alert if something's been in your fridge for longer than 2 weeks. You're like, oh, okay, interesting. Or if somehow if it's like a, in a clear container, it can look at it and say, this is the same thing, but now it's starting to grow green. You should check it out. But even just being able to tell me, like, this container's been in here for a long time, which certain things you have to tell it to ignore, like egg milk cartons, because
well, maybe
always going to look the same.
Well, maybe, and I say maybe that's the trick, is that it would just have like a... You know, it would have a 3D, like it would know the volume and size of things inside there and their location. So it would have an, it would have a 3D, like, mapping of the location of everything and could tell you how long it's been there. Just how long the milk has been there for. When was the last time it came out of the, yeah. Like I said, it's not the full, like, not even that is the full idea. The full idea is it understands that it's a new gallon jug of milk,
right?
And will tell you how long it's been in there, and will order you a new one when you're out. Like that is really the that's the whole great idea. An okay idea is just keeps track of how long it's been in there. The edge of an okay idea is that for your eggs, which
well, and it's like
on it.
And I think that's a great idea for certain staples like eggs, milk, butter. You know, I'm like,
right. Yeah,
when that gets low, just automatically order me another one and have it show up. That'd be awesome.
Who puts butter in the refrigerator? That's disgusting.
Well, you know, when you buy the box, the big box.
Oh, okay. That's a good point. You gotta,
yeah.
Touché, James.
The next one is i.con.
Ah.
It's, never mind. I'm not going to go there. Or the next one. Number 7 is a...
Go to our website if you want to... the PG-13 version of the podcast.
yeah. That should... Yeah. So there you go. This next one, I... Okay, it's called Garagio.
Okay. It's very Italian sounding.
Yeah.
Garagio.
It's it's a garage door opener with your smartphone. So I'm like, I totally want that. Why is that one bad?
honestly, that one doesn't seem over the top to me because exactly. It's like Can I get rid of my garage door opener? Does my phone have GPS so it can I can put up a GPS fence so it'll automatically open as I get close? That seems like a distinct improvement over having to keep track of the what's it called? The little button thing.
Yeah, little clicker. Well, and I'm like, for things like me, I'm like, honestly, the GPS, I want to go the other way around. When both our phones get outside the range, I want it to automatically shut just in case I forget. Or 10 o'clock at night, automatically shut. There's more than one time where it's like middle of the night, or not middle of the night, but you know, it's nighttime. I'm going in to put something in the garage and go, oh, the door's open. I should close this. You know, I have yet to have a morning when I wake up and the garage door's open. But you know, I mean, that's a concern. Or like legitimately, give me an alert if I'm not home and it opens up. But anyways, I was like, oh, come on. I thought this one was interesting. The Amazon Dash was one where, like, look, there are some where it makes sense. Kitty litter, detergent, you know, which the Dash button, that would be nice for, you know, even in your fridge for some of those things, right? And that's actually your solution.
Right.
A bunch of those buttons in your fridge that you just press. But anyways, he goes, but there are some of them that are weird. Like, there's a Dash button for pistachios. I'm like, really?
Yeah, some people really like pistachios, James. They're pretty exciting.
I love this comment at the end, though. It says, if I ever went to someone's house and they had a pistachios Dash button, she goes, I'd press that thing like 50 times. Oh, man. How about this one? How do you feel about this one? Nespresso's Prodigio. Prodigo? It's a Bluetooth-connected coffee machine that can tell you when you're out of their dumb little coffee pods, which you shouldn't use anyways because they're killing the planet. It can also start brewing the coffee from afar, but only if your chosen pod is already loaded. Which I was like,
I'm going to be honest.
That sounds like a thing. I don't
like a fully connected like coffee maker that like you just load it up with like, you know, it's got like five different like bean containers. So you could put like different flavors into each one of them. Definitely not decaffeinated, because what is wrong with you? Why does it exist in the world? But like, you've got all these different options for where what you can put in with each one, and then like it'll grind the beans and make the coffee and like put the ground, like the used grounds in like a disposable thing and self cleans and can like, you can set timers on it. You can start it from afar and it'll alert you when you run out of beans. Like a fully automatic makes you a fresh cup of Joe would be very cool. Like you got a couple of these little cup things left. I don't know. I kind of feel like it again. A lot of these aren't necessarily bad ideas. They're just on the edges of good ideas.
Right. Well, and for me, I'm like, I could get it if someone, you got your coffee kick and you set your alarm for 6 a.m. and you set a timer for your coffee thing to start cooking at 6. And as long as you know to put the little pod in at night as part of your bedtime routine.
I will say that seems legit. Those pod things, like especially if you get one of the slightly more expensive ones that have a water reservoir that they keep hot. So you literally walk up, put your cup in underneath, put the pod in and hit go. And a minute and a half later, you have a hot cup of coffee. Like those things.
That's pretty nice.
I was going to say, the only way you're going to convince me to spend another chunk of money for a more advanced one is something that like I don't even remember the cups, because the cups are like automatic. And like this thing says, like the cups aren't particularly great for the environment. And if it's fully automatic, you can just throw beans into it and it'll take care of it. Like right. that to me is the next stage. Not like you can set a timer to automatically make your new cup if you remember to put a new cup in there. But
yeah. Number 10 is Shutterees.
Yeah.
This smart plantation shutter relieves you of the horrific burden of getting up to close your shutters after a long day of blogging.
Look, I like that.
I want to do it with windows, so I'm not going to complain too loud. But the shutter. How about this one? Blue Smart Luggage. It's a connected carry-on, promises you the ability to weigh itself, charge your phone, and lock itself. Which, by the way, that last feature, unfortunately, was not all groovy with the TSA, who stopped one of the riders on their way to CES last year and sternly questioned her on the bag's exposed wiring and battery pack. Oh, boy.
Yeah,
I didn't fully think that went through. These next two are made by the same company, Griffin. Their first one is a $100 Bluetooth toaster. It'll send you a notification when your toast is done at your desired level of crispiness.
Look, I work for a company in an industry where we make like high precision heating devices, and I am all behind like super precise toasters, super precise sous vides, super precise everything with wireless internet connectedness. Like, it's sort of our jam. I love them. Like, I am not against a $100 toaster by any means. I'm not sure I could justify it for myself to go out and just like slam down $100.
I have a toaster oven, which I love.
Yeah, and that should be automated too. It's actually when we developed our control software, our heating, our tools have three distinct zones. And so you need one thermocouple for each of them. And they wanted something. They didn't want to have to like build a full one while they were doing testing. So they got three toaster ovens and they like bolted them together and then put TC, like put thermocouple in them, put all like they built this fully automatic three zone heating system so that they could run all of our software on actual hardware. But it was, you know, their toaster oven, so they could make paninis. It's pretty funny.
That is funny. But don't worry. Griffin also makes a connected mirror. It can display notifications from your phone, the weather, and of course, updates from your toaster.
It's awesome.
Which I said, but that only works if you touch the mirror's surface.
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, that's a non-starter. That's why, like, Microsoft's, it's all based on gestures, no touching of the mirror. Mirror touching, that's a non-starter. I like the way you described it. These are all on just the cusp of useful and greatness.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Cloud Pets is number 14. They're toys for kids that they include stuffed animals and robots. And they're connected to the internet. So, you know, you can, I don't know, find out about what they're doing.
You can find out about what they're doing.
Yeah, it says, if nothing else, the news that millions of recordings of children and their parents leaked from CloudPet's database should give you pause.
Oh, yeah.
But then their last comment, which is true, by the way, is that kids will play with literal dirt and rocks, you fools. Don't spend your money on connected toys.
Oh, man. True.
And then finally, number 15, flip-flops. Couldn't forget to mention an Internet of Things device that is connected in perhaps the least useful way possible. This pair of flip-flops with a chip and accompanying app doesn't provide anything conceivably useful like fitness tracking data, but instead sends wearers information about discounts.
That is the dumbest. Okay, that one's not even on the edge of a good idea.
Now, I did appreciate that he did, and now this page isn't fully loading. Bummer. At the end, it has a, I think it's Adult Swim video for an Internet of Things connected thing, and it's called The Pipe.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's a smart pipe that connects to the back end of your toilet, and it's a pretty funny video.
So. this is more of our PG-13 segment, if you want to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it started out okay, and then somewhere in the middle, it took a turn, and it went, oh, and I was, so I didn't actually watch the second half of it, but the first part where...
That's sort of the Adult Swim thing, though, is let's start it out normal, and then somewhere in the halfway point, we're going to take a hard left.
Well, they started talking about privacy features and how it can figure out who you are, and they got very specific.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, there was part of me that's like, wow, they really thought this one through. But I mean, it was like, essentially, they started talking about like the equivalent of Touch ID, but
Yeah.
How Twilight would use it. And how that would ID you. And yeah, super funny. But they were just like, some of the stuff, it was so great. We're like, yeah, you can get an update, then you can share it with your friends, and then we sell your data. It's great.
Then we sell your data. Oh man. That's funny.
So bad. But, yeah, I appreciate that. Internet of Things, man. That's, you know what? You gotta have some failures to find the great ones. I was listening to the podcast today. It was called the Startup Podcast, and it was talking about this guy who invented the slap bracelet. You know that thing?
Yeah.
And super interesting, and it was an interesting story, but it was like, dude, that sucker's super dumb. But like, it was on fire for 9 months, and everyone had one. You're like, I don't know, sometimes you gotta go through those things to find the truly great products. And that's like we said, some of these are on the cusp of, you go, you know what? A thing that can figure out how many eggs you have, that's dumb. But, you know, useful, and it leads you to that next step. And yeah.
The thing that is especially frustrating is that there's a big difference between being on the edge of a great idea and pushing out an MVP that doesn't, a minimal viable product that doesn't quite reach that idea, but is a stepping stone towards it, versus something that is the edge of a good idea. It is a minimally viable product technique, but it's a stepping stone. And that's what I see a lot of these as. Like the egg minder thing is not a stepping stone to that bigger problem. We're going to solve one specific area of it and ignore the fact that this doesn't generalize at all.
Well, that's what I appreciated about like Google Home, I think, is an example where it's clearly just the beginning.
Yeah.
They don't do everything.
Right.
And there's clear gaps, but you can also see they know it.
It is. Yeah.
And it is. And they're working on it. With the egg minder, you're like, do they know it? And I think about when the iPhone first came out, everyone complained, well, it doesn't do cut and paste. And they're like, yeah, whatever. We'll get to that. We're going to solve some things that nothing else can do right now. We're going to focus on those high value where you go, man, I almost can't live without that. And then what we're going to do is we'll go back and fill in those gaps.
Right, so that solution.
So I totally get it. And some of these products, you're like, I don't know if they're, or if they're just like, Internet of Things, let's make
this. Yeah, no, this definitely feels like a marketing grad is hanging out with his friend who plays with Arduino, and they're like, we'll create an Internet of Things thing and we'll Kickstarter, it'll be awesome, and people will Kickstarter things, learn how to make video. Like a lot of these feel like the one in particular, which that definitely had that feeling, it was the oh man, which one was it? It was because I clicked on a bunch of these as I was going through, and might have been the egg tray. Was it?
You got a couple options.
I gotta say, it's not particularly important. No, it was the water bottle one. That one definitely feels like a couple of college kids are like, dude, you can kickstart anything. especially watching the video, but man, yep. So you know what, James? This is my question. Let's say you have one of these products. You weren't really expecting it to take off, so you didn't have a big run of it. But once you actually released it to the wild,
you don't know how many people need a water bottle that glows.
You
gotcha.
Literally never had them in stock because as soon as any more were delivered, they were bought up in an instant. I mean, just crazy demand for way outstrips your supply. What would you do with that product?
Keep making it, charge more, figure out how to increase supply.
And this is why you are a failure and Nintendo is a success, because they know the right answer, which is announce that you're discontinuing the product.
is that how that logic works?
It's kind of weird. So Nintendo last year, we didn't make a big deal about it at the time because they had the Switch gearing up, and I just didn't really talk about it a little on the show, but they had the NES Classic Edition. It's basically they took a Raspberry Pi system on a chip, little microcomputer, And they loaded it up with some soft...
It's got a classic controller that plugs in via USB, right?
Yeah, it's not USB, it's a proprietary connector. But it's like the classic controller. And so it looks like the NES, except it's smaller. You don't plug games into it. It has preloaded software, but it's got a handful of classic NES titles on it.
30 games, yeah, right?
Exactly. And they also like spend a lot of time working on the video output so that they could like emulate the look of a ray cathode TV on LCD screens and stuff like that. I mean, like they went,
that's funny.
Yeah, it was a clever little thing because all they had to do was basically download the ROMs from the internet that people had already built. Like they didn't have to do much engineering on this thing at all. They had to make a little plastic case, and then just ramp up production. This thing was a piece of cake. They were selling it for like $60 and the demand was enormous.
So HP is one of those, actually. We made a product we've talked about it on the podcast. It's the Sprocket. It's a little tiny printer that doesn't actually use any ink, and it prints off like a business card size photo.
Yeah.
And that was one where they like, yeah, we made a million of them and sold out. And we were like, whoa, this is actually a thing. And so HP totally doubled down on it. We're coming out with we're working on another version of it that's going to be better. They've got a third version that's in R&D, which is going to be, sounds really cool. And so they're like investing in it and making it and deciding to not sell other printers and sell the Sprocket instead, which I don't know how I feel about that as someone who is part of the ink business.
And
you know, whatever.
Use ink.
But I get it, right? They're doubling down because it's successful. And that's what you would normally expect from a normal company.
Yeah, but for some reason, Nintendo has decided, they announced this week, they're basically like, yeah, we're not going to make any more. We've shipped all the ones we're going to ship. What? quite unexpected. There's theories going around for why this is. One of which is that it's the fault of the Nintendo Switch, which is their latest generation console. And I have to tell you something that happened this week, James, regarding the Nintendo Switch.
What happened this week regarding the Nintendo Switch?
So,
did you get one?
Somebody beat us to the punch. Kind of. I did get one, James.
Really?
And I immediately gave it to my girlfriend. She got a new job, and we'd been kind of talking about, she'd said she wanted one.
Is it amazing?
Yes.
Is Zelda amazing?
Yeah. I haven't really played it much. I'll be honest.
I'd gotten over the fever dreams and had moved on with my life. This is not helping me.
Nope. She had wanted one. She had never owned a video game system. She grew up in she grew up in the 80s where boys played video games. And so like her brothers had video game systems, and being classic brothers, they wouldn't let her play. And you know, it's always hard to go over to
were the same.
Yeah. And it's always hard to go over to your friend's house and be like, play video games at your friend's house, because they're like, I thought you want to hang out with me and not just play nice video games. So she never really got an opportunity to play. I was just sort of pushed out of it, you know, largely because she was a girl. And that's how it was in the 80s, James. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of the opinion that you shouldn't have to buy your own first video game system. Like, we all got it as gifts. Like, I'll pay it that's forward. True. So I got her a gift of her first video game system.
What game did you get her, Zelda, to go with?
Of course, man.
I'm just checking. I don't know.
I thought.
I don't know what girls play.
I actually thought about making her get it herself, just getting into the system, because
yes.
You cannot buy these things, like, straight up. Like, you can't get them from Target, from Amazon, from Walmart. They are in such hot demand that it's like, I called around to the stores for like days being like, do you have any in store? And they're like, no, we don't have any in store. And they would,
I remember that was just like the Wii. Right. And that was one where I was like on a whim, and it had been out for probably a couple months. I was like, I'm interested. And I think I called like four or five places, and they were like, sold out, sold out, sold out. And there was some, I'm trying to remember, it was like inside of a Nordstrom, like that kind of like a store within a store type of thing. And I'm like, yeah, we right. got one. I'm like, I will be there.
Exactly. And that's, and so I ended up having to venture into the wasteland of Craigslist. And
really?
Yeah. But I had to buy it in cash via the Craigslist. It was actually a really nice kid who had bought.
Was it new or used?
It was new, brand new. He had bought.
Did you pay a premium?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's why I almost made her buy video, make her own game. Because it's like, look, I've already bought you a game equivalent. I'm just kidding. This. But, wow. Yeah, it was a. But the kid was really nice. He had bought two because you couldn't buy an extra dog. So he was like, I'll buy two. Then I can have one to share with friends and we'll have the second dock. And he was like, it just doesn't seem worth it. And he was charging a premium because he made money off the deal.
Ugh. Why not?
But yeah, it was like, and it was crazy too, because he was asking less than literally everybody else I had seen. It was the cheapest new one. Like normally it's like $360 for a, I've already beaten Zelda and I'm selling it because I can sell a used one and make $60 off of it.
Yeah.
And this kid was selling it brand new for less than that. So I jumped on it right away and he was telling me, he was like, oh yeah. Like as soon as we agreed to meet, he goes, I started getting blown up with emails coming, like just an endless number of people being like, is it still for sale? Is it still available? but yeah, it's crazy. So Nintendo's in a bit of a thing right now, dealing with a constrained supply on every front, which I think is probably the answer to this question, is they were struggling pretty hard after the Wii U debacle. And by debacle, I mean nobody buying them. And so I have a feeling that they're a little bit cash-strapped right now, and they're just pouring every resource they have into trying to rev up the Switch, you know, production. And I have a feeling that, like, if you think about it, if it costs them, you know, if they're going to make, let's do a little math here, James. They're selling for $60 each. Let's say that, you know, worst case scenario, they make $30, you know, for production and shipping and everything. And they sold out of the 40,000 that they made. So let's say they're going to make 100,000. How many zeros is that? One, three. It's $3 million in cash, right? Which is 10,000.
Doesn't sound like a lot.
Right, which is 10,000 Switches. That could be the problem. Is they're like, look, we've got a small budget and we're taking on loads of debt. We're cutting everything that isn't pouring liquid assets into.
That doesn't mean you say we're not making it anymore. You just keep the supply constrained.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're crazy. The only other explanation, so there's two other explanations that I actually think merit some consideration. One is that they realize they have a hit on their hand, but it's a static system. It doesn't, you buy it, it comes with the games and you're done. If they were to do a little R&D, they could throw in a Wi-Fi chip into the thing. And then make a store where you could buy classic games for it. And they could slowly release the system.
That doesn't mean you stop selling the existing one.
I know. I agree. And then the other explanation, and Nintendo doesn't seem like it's this sort of company. But it's, there is a one of the advantages of these limited run systems is that it's sort of like, why does the McRib never come out at the same time every year and it only comes out from limited runs? It's a hugely successful product for McDonald's, but yet they've never deployed it to all of their restaurants at the same time for a continuous period and it's because McDonald's leaves the McRib success isn't the fact that it's a really tasty sandwich. They believe that the McRib success exists in the fact that it's only got limited availability. It is the fact that it's the limited availability of the McRib is why people go crazy for it. Because when it's available, they go and eat it way more than they'd ever eat it under normal circumstances. Because anywhere where they've actually put it into circulation for long running periods, it stagnates and doesn't sell well. But any market where it's available for a month, people go crazy over it. It's the same reason why Disney has their vault for their princess movies, because they're like, when they, you know, it's a digital resource. You can copy it an infinite number of times. Why would you stop selling it? Well, it's because when Beauty and the Beast goes back in the vault for, 2 months, they can be like, Beauty and the Beast is going back in the vault. And I'll probably sit there and be like, oh, great. So this is my last opportunity to buy it in the current formats for the next, however long. Well, I guess I'll pay the full price for it. And so that
they got the signature series of Pinocchio and Snow White, and I've been on one of them.
Yeah.
I was like, all right. Because I know it's not going to last forever.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's,
but this seems different. Hardware is different.
It does. It totally feels. It feels like a mistake. It feels like a company that's just gone crazy. And it's almost like they're panicking, and they're just making a mistake here.
Yeah, something. It's weird.
Yeah, we're missing a piece of the information. I haven't gotten an explanation that totally.
This would be an amazing case study in business school in like 10 years to hear like what was happening behind the scenes and what led to this decision. And usually with cases, what they do is then they just give you all the information.
Yeah.
And then you have to decide what to do with it. And, and obviously their choice was, we're going to cut it, but yeah, something. Maybe it is a combination of the capital. Maybe their margins aren't quite there. Maybe the product is kind of limited and tip add a Wi-Fi chip would add just so much complication that it's just not worth it. Maybe they've got something in store for the Switch where you'll be able to play these classic games. And it could be one of those where they're just like, yeah, I don't know.
I've heard one theory states that one of the things that I've read comment sections of, and I haven't actually read an article that defends this, but I've read this in the comment sections on Reddit and stuff, but they talk about how this is completely to do with Japanese culture and how the Japanese culture has some weird idiosyncrasies and by American standards. And if you understand the Japanese culture, this totally fits. This feels like something that makes sense because they're catering to the Japanese community and I would say, and then ... It just sort of trails off, and I'm like, you might be absolutely right, but you have come far from convincing me that, like, culture can be incredibly powerful.
Tell me about the culture. What about it?
What's the lock here? Why would you cut a successful product off at its knees? And, I'm like I said, I'm not saying they're wrong about it. It just, I don't know. Anyways, so the Nintendo Switch, my girlfriend's got one.
Dude, that's awesome, man. Yeah. I'm so jealous.
She's Switch. You know what's going to get you the most jealous, James? It's not that she has the Switch. It's that she got a new job that she's starting tomorrow. And so she is moving up to the North Bay and is going to be up there without anything to do for a week except go for work. And like, she's got an Airbnb right now, so she's gonna for the week so that she can like look for permanent places. But like, when she comes home in the evenings, all she will have is a Switch and time.
So I take it you're not gonna look at that one job I sent you up here in Oregon?
Oh, I looked at it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's just it's interesting, James. It's an interesting. Yeah, to me, it's not the fact that you have the video game system; it's the you have the video game system and time to play it. That's where the real magic happens. So I read this really interesting kind of thought piece, and it brought up an interesting question about the future of cameras. And where cameras are going. Because, like, you know, we usually think of cameras in two categories. You get your DSLRs, which are your, like, super high-end professional cameras, your Nikons and such. And then you've got your phone cameras, your, you know, got a certain number of lenses, and you got some hardware stuff. But one of the biggest differences between the DSLRs and the phone cameras is the fact that the DSLR is all about, you've got a series of lenses and, you know, a range of different expense, but like you're physically manipulating the light rays coming into the sensor. And then you want a really big sensor that you can saturate with light. Then you want to capture as much of that raw data as possible and hold that raw data in the raw, like the .raw format. Then you'll go back to your computer and you'll bring it into whatever your photo editing software is, and you will then take that raw picture and take the data out of it, essentially, and turn it into the picture you're going to sell, whatever. And so a lot of your photo techniques are about how do you get the best pictures for post-processing. Whereas one of the big differences is that phone cameras tend to be very limited because of their physical size. There are issues with the lenses. A bigger sensor is better. Having big pixels to sense with is better. Like classically, your high-end cameras will have enormous sensors that don't have very many more megapixels than cell phone cameras. And the reason for it is because each pixel has a larger surface area, and that ends up with a better picture. And so Apple for years had to make the case that, you know, a 40 megapixel camera wasn't going to make a good picture. It was a large pixel size, which resulted in fewer pixels because of the size constraints of the phone. They had a lot of success doing that strategy specifically because Apple didn't rely strictly on raw pixel data from the phone. They started developing their own silicon and their own software to do post-processing of the photos. So before it even got to your screen for you to start playing around with the little sliders and add filters to Instagram, the photo was already heavily edited automatically by the software to compensate for the lack of ability in the hardware. And this is a road that we keep going further down. One of the reasons why Google's the Pixel phone camera is so praised is not the fact that the raw camera sensor is that great. It's good. It's very good. But where Google has really excelled is they've used a tremendous amount of their engineering prowess to develop software that turns them into great pictures. Even Apple with the latest version of their phone, with the dual lens, it's about taking two pictures and then taking all that data and through software adding different effects. And that's the direction we're going is what this article argues, is they're heading in the direction of how do you use software more and more. And so he sort of poses this hypothetical question of, is it possible to create a lensless camera?
A lensless camera.
A pure software camera. It's a funny theoretical thought experiment. So this is the idea. What you'd have is you'd have a phone, obviously, without the camera on it. You'd bring up the camera app and you would point it at whatever you want to take a picture of. And Google would have taken so many pictures of planet Earth that whatever you're pointing at, they've got a database for it. They know your location because they got your GPS sensor. They've got your orientation because of the accelerometer, gyroscope, and compass. They know all sorts of information about, like, the time of day, the season of the year, things like that. And then they can take this massive database of information they have, and all their pictures, and then have the software automatically generate an image of what you're looking at the time of day and everything, and just build it in.
Interesting.
And then every photo you have will be these super high end, professional looking photos, because you know.
Yeah.
And if you want to pose inside of it, well, theoretically, you've gone to Facebook, you've uploaded a bunch of your own selfies and whatever, and so just say, oh, I want to be in this picture, and they'll just put you into the picture that you're taking.
Wow.
And it's a funny thought experiment, because when you look at stuff that people post to Instagram and whatever, like, it's all heavily edited, like, to make sure you look as good as possible. And
yeah.
so it's just like, just go all the way. Make it for software.
That's kind of...
It's a weird idea, and you know, obviously, there's some obvious flaws in this. Like, let's say you're taking photos of a sports game. That's never happened before. It's not going to work perfectly. But it's one of the things that I think is really fascinating about this is that that's the direction we're going with cameras. Is that
how long do you have to actually be there? Could I, like...
Right?
Get a photo of a place that I've never actually been to?
Well, theoretically, that's what you'd be able to...
Total Recall style?
Exactly. You were there. But it's... I love this idea in what kind of shows you that, like, the far-flung... What I like about it is the idea that your camera sensor is really one part of a more complicated picture-producing... device, and especially in the fact that so much of what we do is already done in software. We have this idea that our camera captures a moment of real life, and it doesn't, not really, like, at all, especially with, like, modern cell phone cameras, because so much of the processing is done automatically the moment you take the picture. It's the reason why Apple doesn't allow you access to the raw pixel information, because as far as they're concerned, like, that's not the picture. It's not.
That's interesting.
And I say, and the pixel data for them, I suspect the reason why they don't give you the raw pixel stuff isn't anything proprietary. It's that it doesn't look good. It's difficult to process. They've built these sensors that don't actually take good pictures. They've built sensors that, when coupled with their software, produce a fake image that we see as, oh, this,
that they're pretty certain is the most closest to reality.
Right. And
yeah, it's not, interesting idea.
And we're going further down that direction. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. But it's like, what's the end game for cameras? It's really the question that this article poses. And I have a feeling that kind of nails it, that there's going to be a lot more along the lines of composite images, especially if stuff like, you know, the Project Tango phone, as you get more into augmented reality, one of the big tricks of augmented reality is it is contextually aware of the physical space that it's in. And so you could theoretically, like, be constantly recording a room or a place, building up a picture of what the thing looks like in 3D. And so as you take pictures of the room you're in, it becomes higher and higher resolution and more clear, because it's augmenting it with all sorts of information that it could never capture with a single picture. But when it knows where you are in the room, and it knows what the rest of the room looks like, and it knows everything you've already recorded, you know, the camera module is basically just verifying, okay, what's actually, you know, what's already there. You know,
right.
Did something move? I don't know. It's a really interesting idea about how we develop cameras, what it means to take pictures in the modern day.
Well, it reminds me of that, Apple's idea for artificial intelligence, where it's like you have one mothership AI, and then you have satellites that don't have to be as smart. They just have to know what the references are.
Right.
And then, you know, so you could have that same thing with the photos, where you've got awesome high quality ones, and maybe you do have a camera, but it's black and white. it's low pixel. You know what I mean? Right. It's just looking for certain things, like you said, like figuring out where you're at, and goes, okay, this is it. And then we grab the real photo from you.
Well, and one of the classic examples that they've been trying to deal with for years is Notre Dame. Like, if you want a picture of you in front of Notre Dame all by yourself, you can't get that except in software. You have to figure out how to delete the people. And, like, Adobe came
up with... Yeah, Microsoft did a cool project with that.
Right, exactly. And it's exactly what they did, was they took thousands and thousands of different pictures. And then they did key point tracking on those pictures to figure out where...
Well, they didn't even take the pictures. They just grabbed them from the web,
They downloaded it from Flickr, and then they built a composite... image, a super high resolution image of Notre Dame, and it had the artifact of, because they were looking for key points, things that were repeated in multiple photos, people never were, and it automatically removed all the people from the image. And all of a sudden, like, I can totally see that. You're at Disneyland, and there are just these super high resolution maps of Disneyland, and you go out and walk out in front of it, you take a picture of it. And if it's one of those rare areas of the world where Google knows that we have an enormous number of photos of this area, and you can click delete all the people, and they'll just process, you take a picture of you in front of it, and you select the people that you want to keep in the image, and it will just automatically delete everybody else. And it'll be super high resolution, and it'll be like, you know, and you'll just scroll out or zoom in because they can just add information as you need it. We should build this, James. We're doing it again. We're giving away a brilliant idea. I know how to build this. Even as I'm saying it, I'm like, I can do this. Like, I couldn't do it well, but I could build a prototype. Yeah, I don't know. I just, this definitely feels like there's a there, James. And having many low resolution or multiple low resolution cameras with a tremendous amount of software back seems like it's going to be the route that ends up with the best picture, as opposed to what DSLRs do, which is have super high end camera modules and, you know, and you'll never replace those. I would suspect. I think those will always have a place, actually taking pictures. But
yeah, like Sporting is a great example of that.
Right. But how great would
it be? It's hard to composite a great catch.
Yeah. Well, except for the idea that as long as you got a picture of the catch and your camera is taking, you know, giant, super high resolution pictures at 60 hertz, so you're basically creating a video of the picture, and then you can supplement it. So if you wanted to show empty stands, you know, which is all things that we're getting better and better at doing automatically and on the fly, which is the really crazy part to me.
Right.
You know, and then go through and re-render, you know, do some post rendering to really make it super high quality. Put that on your Sports Illustrated. I could see us in a world where it doesn't.
I'm even thinking like the depth effect, right? From the iPhone. That's not what you really see.
Yeah.
Because that was part of my original thing was like, yeah, but the people in the stands, like that's a part of it, but maybe you don't want it to be.
Right. And I don't know. I think we're going in this direction where we have to start rethinking what we think about. Maybe. Okay. I'm going to say something right now, James. And I want you to brace yourself for it, because
I'm ready.
I don't feel good about saying it, but
I'm braced.
You know, maybe Snapchat isn't completely crazy with their whole "we're a camera company."
I wasn't ready for that.
I think that they, as a company, have a lot of stuff that they struggle with. Particularly, they've got a CEO that is intolerable. But the idea of saying, no, Apple only does part of the job in taking the picture. The rest of the camera is a digital service. And I could see a company, I can see there being a space for that as a technology company. And your hardware all of a sudden all of a sudden dumb ideas like we're gonna put a camera module, like a low quality camera module, into sunglasses. But if you back that up with some really sophisticated software to improve the picture that you're downloading, which they're not, so I still criticize them for this on overall. But the core idea of, you know, cheap cameras everywhere doesn't necessarily mean bad photos if you're a software company that builds software cameras.
Right.
And, you know, yeah, I don't know. It's just somebody convinced them. Yeah, whatever. I don't want to make this about Snapchat. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting, I thought it was a really interesting idea, and it kind of changes how I think about cameras. Not fundamentally, but definitely where I thought we were going. And I think it changes what I think about it because it fits so nicely into what I already knew about cameras of like, oh yeah, that clearly is the direction. It's this, they want to be able to build a hypothetical lensless camera. And then the act of having a lens will just make the pictures that much better because you can start to capture other information. You can start to focus on the specific thing you want the picture of, and everything else can just be added in later in software to fill in the rest of the picture. You want right. that, you know, you want that great picture of that mountain. Cool. We've already got that for you. It's going to be the best picture of that mountain you've ever seen. And your camera only has to focus on adding you and making sure you look really good in that moment. And the rest of the context can be added later. And as far as you'll remember, it's exactly what it looked like because our brains aren't particularly good at remembering those sorts of details. So it doesn't really matter. but yeah.
That is interesting.
Man, I'm blowing my mind, man. I like this time of the year when these sorts of thought pieces get pushed out. It's fun to have new releases every month or every week, but sometimes it's nice to just sit back and think about stuff.
I feel like you could have both, though. You could have really high-end cameras and...
I think for me, we tend to think of, who has the best hardware for their cameras. And even I was sort of judgy of the Pixel, the Google's Pixel, because I was like, it's not that good of a camera when you look at it compared to these other things. But I was thinking about it wrong. And especially because I'll draw this. One of my coworkers he's barely a coworker anymore because he has a really successful photography business. And at one point we had him take pictures of one of the systems we were building. And my boss commented on how bad the photos looked. And he pulled them up and the guy was like, well, I haven't processed them yet. They're super saturated so that I can go and edit them later and they'll look really nice. Like,
interesting.
He goes, I've captured all sorts of data that I can later extract from this raw photo. So yeah, it looks kind of bad right now. And he was absolutely right. They look amazing and super professional after he processed them all. But that was something it's one of those things where I knew it, but I hadn't really thought about it that in that context where, yeah, he's got a really nice professional grade camera, but it's his professional grade software and his ability to use it that is as important as the camera.
Yeah.
The camera just captures the raw data. The software makes it look good.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I guess to me, that's the big thing, is that's where we're going with cameras is yeah, there still will be a place for super high-end cameras, but software will just keep on being more and more important in extracting data from a quote bad picture, from a bad raw image, and turning it into a good image automatically, or giving artists the tools to turn it into a good image, and adding other stuff that you didn't capture. It'd be impossible to capture because there are people standing in front of the building you were trying to take a picture of or whatever, and it can fill in the details automatically.
Yeah, that part's very interesting.
Right. And the other idea is like you take a picture of the moon and you like and it looks terrible because you don't have a telephoto lens. What if you could automatically do that and all of a sudden magical automatic telephoto lenses? Like this other stuff's happening. It's gonna be so cool because they could do it in software, and then that's what, you know. Obviously there are limitations to this whole thing, but over time that's the direction that they're going. That's the hypothetical that they're working towards. That's what guides this weird twisting. What's the ease that a lot of these companies are working on right now? It's like the question of what is Google trying to build? They're trying to build a computer from Star Trek, and every new technology that they develop, you see it as like, oh yeah, I could see how this is another small step towards this inevitable thing. And I think that's the, as a hypothetical, they're never going to get there, or they might, you know, detour before they ever get there. But right now, that is what is governing their roadmap.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. Huh. Interesting. I'd be fascinated to see how that gets sold to consumers. But
well, they'll sell it by saying it takes the most beautiful pictures ever. Every time, you know,
I'm trying to figure out a way. I read an article that's not tech related, but I would love to integrate it.
Go for it.
And so, it was an interesting piece about, American Express actually, which is really struggling to grow. They've shrunk like 2 years in a row, and their biggest problem is that they're not getting new members. And, the way credit cards work is, for the most part, you target, 30 to 35, 36-year-olds.
Oh, no.
And become their card of choice.
That's terrible news, because for the first, I had the first thought of, I'm probably old enough I could manage a credit card nowadays. I had that thought like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
And that's funny. And so that's who credit card companies go after. Because once they get you, you're essentially a customer for life.
Right.
Because you get rewards and blah, blah, blah. And American Express is suffering from the fact that their brand is, elitism. And
sounds like the brand for me.
Uh-huh. And snobbery and, things like that. But that's not what millennials are going for. Hmm. And instead, they're going for interesting, and that's just not what Amex. That's not their brand. One of the curses of having a strong brand, is it's hard to change it.
Yeah.
And so, like the example they gave was, they were like, with millennials, they don't want to be like, they're not going to talk about the fact that they got a first class plane ticket to where they were going. It's now they're going to post a photo of them spelunking in Greenland, or Iceland or something, right? And it's
so funny.
I'm on an adventure.
I had friends that went to Iceland for the weekend, and it's just like the fact that that's the one you go with. It's hilarious.
It was the article.
I'm gonna have to make fun of them for that next week when I see them.
Yeah, but it was this idea of that's an elite, type of thing to do, but what you're going to share is the adventure part of
it.
And I think, and here's how I connect it. I think this idea of being able to get that perfect photo that's even better than what you had feeds into that,
right?
That adventure mindset. And this post is going to look awesome on Facebook, 'cause it's just going to be me and my wife in front of the Notre Dame Cathedral.
Right. And that's,
that is an epic photo that you would want to post.
And somehow it won't feel weird if it's a filter that's done automatically on your phone. Whereas somehow, if you were to invest in the Microsoft technology to have it, it's the same thing that you'd be doing, but it's the fact that the effort so low makes it feel less weird.
Well, and if all of a sudden everyone's photo looks like that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and there's yeah, a, there's a certain. Too. I mean, it's exactly that you're exactly right. Like filters. People made fun of filters for a while, and now we all everybody filters everything because at some point you realize, yeah, pictures just do look better if you add in a couple of filters here and there and just kind of touch it up just slightly and yeah and like you know and it got to the point where Apple just built those filters in automatically and we'll readjust everything to make it look as good as it could possibly look. And so filters in the like in the traditional sense go away because the filters are put there, because if they didn't already filter it, it would look horrible.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a testament to how good of a job Apple has done in building automatic filters, is that we don't use filters on Instagram as much. But
yeah, no, it's true. The one I use is it's that very first one where you can adjust the depth of it, yeah. Black and white. I don't even know what they call that, but
contrast.
The contrast. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're just kind of magically finds the right balance.
Yeah.
And it always looks better. And yeah, that's the only one I use typically.
OpenCV, baby.
Unless it is a bad photo, then I'll use a filter to kind of cover it up.
Yeah. But
which is user error, not Apple's error.
That's such a good, dumb idea. Like, the idea of having stock filters and just building that right into an app. Like, it's so simple. It was such a simple idea. Instagram was built on the simplest of ideas of filters and online storage so you can share them with your friends. And filters, from a technology perspective, has been a solved problem for like 2 decades. So it's not even like they didn't do anything novel, really, other than they put it together and just. Oh, jeez. Oh, man. And they got so rich with that idea. Like, and because they bought by Facebook. It's just ridiculous, man.
It happens. So, speaking of getting so rich, there's a company out there you've probably never heard of them. They're a mattress startup called Purple.
Oh, I've heard of them. But that's because
you've seen the Facebook ads?
YouTube ads, but I actually watched it, like the entire thing. Because I was like, this is kind of funny.
I bought a pillow.
Really?
Yeah. I watched it and went. So I've been, this is actually when I made a comment on Facebook when I was like, dude, Facebook's got me dialed in because I saw like 3 in a row. Yeah. And that was one of them. And I was like, whoa, I want a pillow. I've been looking for a pillow because the one I have is just, I've had it for like over 10 years now. And it's got some features where I'm like, oh, this is just annoying and I'm ready for a new one. But I think about this thing and I'm like, I'm going to sleep on it for at least 6 hours. You know, it's an average of 7 hours a night and I'm probably going to keep it for 10 years. You know, and I'm doing the math and I'm like, you know, I'm not above spending $100 on a pillow. For as much as I use it, if I can get a good one, that has a ton of value. And, you know, thinking the same thing about beds and sheets and all that stuff. And so I've been looking, and there was one that was super interesting. Man.
They don't mess around with the price on these things.
No, they don't. And but anyways, I looked at one and I was super intrigued by it. But they had like 3 different designs or styles, and I was like, I don't know which one I am, and so I just never bought it. And then this one came along and I watched the video of them like dropping the
eggs.
Drop it, or they have the eggs and they're dropping the glass on top of the eggs or something like that. And I was like, fascinating. And started doing some other reviews and I'm like, boom, I'm in. So I bought it, which is not shipping until summer because they, like Nintendo, have way more demand than supply.
It's a pretty good situation, man.
You would think, but instead of canceling their orders, they're just going to keep going. They've grew. How about this? Last year, they had 30 employees. This year, they have 600. So they're based out of Utah, and they bought a storage facility, which is like how do they describe it? It's like three Costcos. Like, this sucker's super long. I'm like, wow, that is big. That's a distribution center is what that is, which is, you know, it's a production slash distribution center, so it makes sense. But anyways, their ones were like, I'm sure we've talked about Casper and some other, we've talked a little bit about mattresses, but these guys, they're totally bootstrapped. They don't have any funding whatsoever.
That's awesome.
Externally, which makes it hard to value them. But they're like, yeah, they're on their way to being worth $1 billion and just growing like crazy. They're bigger than all the other ones. They're like, yeah, just kind of flying under the radar, just doing their thing. And honestly, they were. This was a TechCrunch article. And they were like, we're doing a profile of companies in Utah because there's kind of turned into a tech hub-ish there. And they're like, that's the only reason why we stumbled upon them. Like, we had no idea. There's this company that's just growing like crazy, not talking about it.
It's awesome.
Which is... yeah, it is pretty awesome. So, so Purple. Check them out. Their products. I bet you can guess what color they are. And I showed Jesse a video of it, and she was looking at the material, and it's kind of like, I don't know if you remember like JanSport when they had like that red mesh in the straps of their backpacks.
Yeah,
it's kind of that same ish concept, which I like. And Jesse's like, I don't know. It turns out too, like, totally edible. They don't. Everything they use is.
You got my attention there, man.
Yeah, which they're kind of like. Which I like that they were interviewing a CEO, and he's like, "Yeah, so you know, world ends, zombie apocalypse, you can eat your bed. It's all good." Like, I like that attitude. That's prepared. I'm like, I wouldn't stay in one's place, but you know, whatever.
Right. It's a hyper-elastic polymer. Temperature neutral, free airflow.
Yeah, that's the thing. They're like, it doesn't get hot. You don't get bed sores. All a bunch of awesome stuff, I guess. It's technology. Because that was their original market, was people who were bedridden and couldn't move. And so they had to come up with something that didn't create pressure, but yet was still comfortable and gave you support and all sorts of stuff. And it turned out that more people wanted that.
Yeah. I'd give it a go.
But an interesting company.
You know what? And I'm a really big fan of rewarding companies with clever marketing campaigns, even if their product isn't that great. So I could see going for it without knowing any better. But actually, it's funny. The only reason I actually do need a new bed. So I'll consider this.
I am like, beds are critically important. It's one of the things I'm learning. Because it just...
beds, I agree, beds are critically important. And maybe I've never had a nice bed, but I also think that I don't mind tossing and turning, as weird as that sounds. Like, it just doesn't... If I lie in bed for 7.5 hours, like, I'm pretty well rested. It's not that hard for me.
That's fair.
But interesting. I like it. That's cool. That's pretty cool when your company like just blowing up like that from it's amazing how much this sort of stuff is like, how much it changes these kind of companies. Because, you know, it's obviously it's not a Silicon based company, but it's the internet. It's the ability to sort of grow these products incredibly quickly. Rapid development, build a market. Like, this is not something a company could have done 2 decades ago or even a decade ago. It's because of all the changes of super high tech that a new mattress style can really take off and grow as rapidly as they're growing. I don't know. It's cool. I like it.
Well, yeah, and it's even just this idea of, like, you can roll up the bed and ship it in the mail.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is insane. How does that work?
I've read about them, like, trying to, like, how do you... it basically vacuum it down, and because it doesn't... The advantage that they have is that it springs back and doesn't hold a shape after being compressed. So they literally can vacuum it down into these like tiny packages, much smaller than the actual mattress. And then when you open it up, it just pops open and it's impossible to get back in the package because they've because you don't have the vacuum tools to shrink it down and put it into it.
Well, I'm kind of like, beds are heavy.
Exactly. That
package cannot be light.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just incredible. Just crazy. Yeah, that's definitely something that the internet has changed. You know what? The internet has also had a profound impact, just shopping in general.
Yes.
And how about this for interesting? It turns out that Amazon is killing Google when it comes to the starting point for people shopping online.
Yeah, definitely. I fall into this.
Here, give me 2 seconds.
Okay. 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000. You're over your limit. I just start telling what my experience is. I've noticed that I've been doing this where it's like, if I need to go and buy stuff, and I know that I'm looking for, like, it depends on what sort of a product it is for me. Like if I'm buying electronic stuff and I don't know that Amazon will have it, I'll just Google it. But I've gotten to the point where if I know it's a pretty, like, I could just go to Target and buy it, but I'm going to buy it on Amazon or whatever. Yeah, I just go to Amazon first. I hit on it, and and it's funny because for me, I used to go directly to Google and then type in, razor blades, space amazon.com, and then let Google bring up the first Amazon results, and you get all the Google results too. But I find that more and more I just type in amazon.com into the browser.
All right, I'm back.
So did you mute me through my entire little talk there?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, that's cool, because I realized about halfway through me talking that you weren't paying attention, which means I was like, this is going
to
be weird.
I'm sure it was a great thought. Were you just talking about how you go to you yourself?
Yeah.
Go to Amazon first?
Yeah. You literally, I tried to fill time, and you filled, you summed it up perfectly with that sentence. it's probably a really bad couple of minutes of podcasting.
No, well, the interesting part is they have some data, and it's really only recently that those two have crossed. And because in the previous 2 years, the search engine did get more traffic, and it's like now there's a precipitous drop for search engines when it comes to shopping. And
well, I think one of the things I have a feeling that it's Google's fault, because Google has been pushing their shopping. Well, and it was unintentional. Google has been pushing their competitive stuff. Oh, we can return all sorts of great results, right? And they want you to buy through Google. Well, the ones that they never reach results on is Amazon. Like, they deprioritize Amazon results compared to other customers and stuff. So unless you specifically add in the, I want razor blades, space, Amazon, Amazon's not going to have a result. But if you put in the space Amazon, the top result will be Amazon razor blades. And then their, like, little shopping, like, knowledge graph thing will have no Amazon results in it. So for me, it's, if I want something off of Amazon, I know I'm going to have to look there separately. I'm going to have to do two searches. And since I'm an Amazon Prime member and I know Amazon has the razor blades I want, I'm just going to go to Amazon.com first, man. Sorry, Google, you're not returning the results I want. And so I'm going to skip you. So that totally fits for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, fits for me too. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's, I'm not like, there's a part of me that's like, not surprising.
Yeah.
You know, but I wonder if Google reads this kind of stuff and is like, oh man, you know.
Well, I wonder, I'm sure they, Google is analytic enough, or I'm sure they understand that that's what's happening. So how do they deal with it? You know, do you, how do you, it is the classic problem of Google's not returning the best results. They're prioritizing different type of traffic, and so people are choosing something else because they've learned that, oh, what I want isn't good. Google's not going to find what I want first, so I'm going to try something else. And how long does Google continue down that road before they just finally, you know, jump ship and be like, fine, we'll return Amazon results because that's what people want. And we don't want people going to any place but us. Even if ultimately they buy it through Amazon, we want them stopping at Google first. Because right now they're getting cut out of the conversation completely because they're cutting themselves out of it. It's interesting. I predict by the end of the year, I would bet. Okay, I'm going to give myself a little bit of a cushion. I would get best guess by the end of 2018, you would see that change where more and more Amazon results are going to start popping up when you Google anything. Here's where you can buy it on Amazon, because it's so much worse for them for you to not go to Google first for everything. Even if it results in not their ideal place for you to go and shop.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Wikipedia in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You're looking for the Wikipedia article, so instead of you going to Wikipedia and typing and doing your searches there, Google just returns the Wikipedia article. We get it. We get that's what you want.
Yeah.
Interesante. So there's a little bit of news in the smartwatch world this week. Alphabet's Verily, their medical science company, developed a new smartwatch that they announced. Oh. It is designed entirely around being a medical device and tracking patients and stuff. It's got like an e-ink screen on it. It doesn't do notifications. It doesn't do pictures. It doesn't do anything fancy. It lasts for like a week. But their whole goal is they've jumped into this idea of, if you can build a health tracker that somebody wears all the time, goes to sleep with, wakes up with, there's a huge advantage to that. So Verily, I think quite smartly, decided to make it look pretty and have some continuous functionality in that it looks like, you know, it's got a watch face on it. But its battery lasts forever. So it also, it also can go days and days and days. So you can wear it, like I said, while you sleep and stuff. One of the interesting things about this is Verily isn't going to sell these to the mass market. That's not the point of them. They are designed specifically as a medical research tool. They've built like 10,000 of them or something. They built a lot of them, but they're giving them to patients that they want to do long-term studies on. And so they'll have this watch data in combination with all the rest of your medical records. And the goal there is to do research and try to find signs of, you know, Parkinson's is one of the diseases that they're looking at, but it's like, how do you track Parkinson's progress over time? Are there early warning signs? Are there things that we can do with, they're building a very sophisticated tracker to look for particular things that they think would be indicative of Parkinson's, and then take that technology, take the core concepts, the core things that you need, and generalize them so you can put them in any smartwatch. And now all of a sudden, every smartwatch will have a Parkinson's detector in it, for example. But it's really cool in that this is the sort of thing that that Google Alphabet can do, because they are so rich. They can dump a ton of R&D in this and just build a smartwatch and be like, yeah, look, it's a nice, it's got a silver band and it's got a silver bezel and it's got a leather watch band, and we're just going to give them to patients. It's cool. I like seeing Google do this sort of stuff, especially with Verily, because it does remind me of this, their larger moonshot goal of, this is going to be really expensive and it's going to take a long time to do it, but we're going to do it right. So we get good data, and, mm-hmm. And the end result is going to be that, you know, it might develop an entirely new technique for tracking all sorts of diseases. And it's really cool. And they just kind of quietly announced this week that they're pushing out this program. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up was to contrast it to Fitbit. They made a splash this week in the smartwatch world, and they tried really hard to keep that splash as small as possible because they are having a disaster right now.
Fitbit
bought Pebble and our old favorite smartwatch company. They've bought a couple of smartwatch companies that they're shutting down, and they're trying to really up their game to compete against Apple because people have realized that Apple is a health tracker with a smartwatch built into it, and Fitbit sees what Apple has done and wants to continue down that road. They've actually had quite a bit of success with their Blaze fitness watch,
saw someone wearing it yesterday.
Nice. Yeah, they're pretty cool, you know, and they work.
I think a little less of the person when I see him, but yeah, they're cool.
it's got simple notifications, controls. It's all the different health stuff that Fitbit does. It's a pretty good little product that they've put together. It's not a full blown smartwatch though, and that's really what they want. So they've been developing one for a while, and basically this week they announced that we've completely messed up. Specifically, it sounds like problems with the watch's GPS unit forced the Fitbit team to basically start from scratch. The antenna placement was such that the device couldn't get a strong signal, a pretty big miss for a fitness product.
Kind of needed.
Exactly. The product, the report also claims that Fitbit has problems waterproofing the device, another feature it will need to match up with the Apple Watch Series 2. Indeed, it sounds entirely possible that the watch will launch without waterproofing altogether, which is just crazy. That's to keep up, and to keep up with Apple, which is they're waterproof for swimming and they've got GPS. Those are now they're becoming table stakes. And if you want to be able to build a smartwatch, you have to have these features. And it'll be interesting to see if Fitbit can swing for the fences and drop one of those two things. I think GPS, you absolutely couldn't ship without it. And waterproofing is a real mess. Like that's a real failure.
I agree with you. They're very quickly becoming table stakes.
Yeah.
To be a fitness tracker and not have GPS, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
I'm not a really big swimmer, but every time I go to a pool, I hate having to take my watch off.
I just even like living in Oregon, I think about rain.
Yeah.
It's nice to have to not even think about
right.
it. And to just go, yeah, whatever, get it wet.
Exactly. Cool. And yeah, I don't know, Fitbit, get your act together, guys.
Yeah,
that system on a chip design is or package on a chip, as Apple calls it, is hard to do. These are incredibly difficult challenges. Miniaturizing stuff like GPS antennas is hard. It's really hard. Obviously, Apple's not the only company on earth that can do it. There are lots of companies that can do it. But that becomes all the more important that you do it. You can't just let that one slide, because every Android watchmaker and their brother has got a waterproof GPS smartwatch with a heart rate monitor and everything else. Fitbit is worried most about Apple because they're dominating the market right now. But the simple truth is that, if I were, it's funny because as this conversation started, I was going to say, if I were to get out of the Apple ecosystem, I might go back to Fitbit. And even as I was saying it, I was thinking, no, I wouldn't. I'd go with an Android Wear watch that does everything I want it to do. And you know, just would be ugly, really ugly. Cause that's generally the compromise that you have to make with Android. Android Wear watches, they're either pretty and don't do everything or ugly and do everything. But yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know what Fitbit's doing with their lives right now. Get it together, guys. Get it together.
Yeah.
You're not Apple. You can't ignore an obvious product for 4 years and survive, okay?
yeah. That's just mean. It's true, but it's mean. Okay, I want to talk about bots for a little bit.
Cool.
There's a fun little article in Fast Code Design or fastcodedesign.com. It's you can make your own bots now. Did you know that?
Tell me about it.
Super funny story of this lady who works at, she's a writer, and she made a bot of her boss. It was pretty funny that she then put onto their internal team Slack channel.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which essentially was a little bit snarkier version of her boss that had pretty witty comebacks. And she was like, it was fun. It was interesting. So first and foremost, it uses a program called Dexter, which you can make a bot, man, for free, essentially. They'll let you build it, test it. You can have a single bot up to 100 users for free, and then they start to charge you money if your bot actually starts to take off. So probably not like a Twitter thing, but maybe like a, I don't know. Could be a bunch of things. Anyways.
I would be fun to make a Matthew bot and have it respond to all my iMessages.
There you go. You could do that. And, yeah, super funny. But the point is that, you know, she's kind of learned a few things where she's like that, A, super easy to make one where you can either have canned responses based on a decision tree. You can also add other things like the weather or an RSS feed or stuff like that. But it reminds me a little bit of if this, then that type of things, but in bot form. But it's interesting where she's like, it's just hard to make a useful bot. Like with her boss's bot, you know, it started out with just like clever, witty comebacks. But then she was like, well, let me make something that's actually useful.
Right.
And she just couldn't. And the one thing that she said, like, oh, this actually could be useful. She said, it just turned out like complicating the process because it added a third party in between what they were trying to do. And she was just like, ah, man. And so ultimately they stopped using it. And she was like, okay, fun experiment, but kind of failed. But she was like, the cool part about this software, it was super easy to make. And the only issue is people don't use it. Like, well, that's it is an issue.
Yes.
Just bots are hard to make useful, I guess.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Man, I'm totally going to check this out because I want to build a bot, but
I know. I read it and was like, dang. And she's like, I'm not, she's not technically savvy at all. Yeah. But I'm like, man, that's kind of a fun idea. Just trying to think like, could we have a Furlough Bros bot?
That's what I'm saying, man. That's actually exactly what I'm thinking. Something that our users could, our mavens could go to and be like, give me an interesting tech story of the week. And it would automatically like,
do that.
That's a. Let me think about that.
Okay.
It's one of those good idea weeks, James. We're coming up with good ideas all over the place.
Good ideas. Well, I'm kind of like, wouldn't it be neat if, which again, like, I don't know if this solves a problem or not. But it's like, if I found an interesting story, let's just say we had like a Slack channel. Do I share that story in that channel with the bot, and then the bot adds it to, or she.
I don't know if you've noticed this, James, but we talk for too long, like way too long, and I enjoy it, but we do have to figure out how to get back to bite-sizable like podcasts. Like, how do we figure out? I think I've been thinking about it a lot. I've had a couple of conversations with people. We got to figure out how to do the
coming around.
How to do the show cuts again at the very least, and get them down to 30 minute nugs. Worst case scenario,
20 minute nugs.
Honestly,
20 minutes.
Honestly, and one of the things, one of the parts of that whole process is going to be, how do you build a platform that allows us to do everything we're doing? But, you know, if we're doing it 20 minute nugs, well, all of a sudden, how do you do that five times? How do you make it so that you don't quintuple the work
six times?
I think. Okay. Yeah. How do you not sextuple the work?
Sorry. That's not the point.
But yet make it, you know, but yet do that, produce that. And I think one of the tricks is one of the tools that we could use is something where it's like something that automatically collates our Google Doc stuff. You submit a link in a description and it automatically pushes it into the Google Doc, but it also puts it into a database or something so that our website, like, you just a magic button and you could just be like, boom, I kind of like it produces the post, as the post is built the exact same way every time. If we could just like have the information be put into forms, and we could say these are where the splits are for the entire podcast, and then have it do the automatic splits, cut it at the time, add the intro and outro, set up the six different posts with the specific, you know, articles included on it, set them so that they release 5 days a week, you know, 20 minutes every morning, stuff like that. But I don't want to build all those tools myself, because A, that's a lot of effort, and B, they're not going to be robust and reliable, and that makes me worry.
Well, and honestly, something that, and here we're talking about the show on the show, which is awesome, but like a better system would be, that daily post is talking about the news that happened the day before, not a week and a day before. And
that's
then
a good point.
We would have, the weekend would be a summary. Somehow that would be better. So like you're talking about, we read an article that day, you give a blurb that's either written or audio, which would be interesting. And then it takes that, and like you can imagine a system where, yeah, we add a link and, you know, and I don't know, like somehow we write something or we just speak it and then it translates it, or not translates it. What's that? When it
transcripts it,
transcribes it. And
yeah, transcribe is the real word, not transcript.
Somehow finds a photo that is not copyrighted, or maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
Machine learning, James. That's the artificial AI. What is the A?
Where you steal
for?
A photo, put a filter on it.
Yeah,
it's a new photo, right?
Exactly.
It's almost fair use.
It feels fair, but yeah, I don't know. It's just I think, and I look at something like this. If a bot ends up being the underpinning for that sort of quick touch the service, give it the information, because I could see this, to bring it back around to this bot conversation, I could see something like that be like, what you do is you say, hey, bot, I want to make a new post. And it goes, okay, what's the link for the article? And you say, this is the link, or there's no link, or whatever. But you like you send it information. Okay, that's stored. What do you want to say about it? Or you can type out a six second thing for your commentary, or you record a little thing and then up the, you know, and record the audio link or do a video, and it would automatically take those chunks of information that it's asked you. Hey, what's this thing? What's this thing? What's this thing? Okay, and then you hit, you know, post, and then it will, if this and then that into an actual post. And if there are tools that are out there that are already designed to do that, even if it is, have the bot talk to if this, then that, then post it to our WordPress site, you know, and using all the different API chains. But we're
well,
using
the nice part about, like, if you had it in a Slack, is I could see it, so you wouldn't double submit.
Right.
And maybe even have the option to let me add a commentary on top of yours before it posts, you know, potentially.
Right.
Like, that would be interesting. It reminds me of, there's an app that I use. It's called OneShot. It's actually super cool. If you if you're reading an article and there's a section that you're like, oh, this is an awesome point, you take a screenshot of that on your phone, and then you open up the app, and the app it instantly pulls up what your latest screenshot was, and you can also flip the previous ones and you go, okay, this is the screenshot, and then what it does is it turns it into, it does the OCR, you know, it figures out what your what the words are, essentially. And then it lets you do two things. Number one, you can highlight the exact part that you care about, like, you know, highlighting words like you could on a Kindle type of thing, right? It's not just like a get a box. It's actually the words. You can choose the color, the background, blah, blah, blah. It's amazing. But then it analyzes that section of the text and most of the time can tell you, it finds the link article for you. Which really? Is super cool.
It's very cool.
Well, yeah, right? Which I'm always amazed. I'm like always amazed. I'm like, how did it do that? It's so cool. Or worst case scenario, it's like, oh, we couldn't find it. You go and you go back to the webpage, you copy the link, and then when you go back to the app, it's like, it'll actually say, paste URL from your copied thing. You do that, it then finds all the metadata, you know, it gets the title and the author and stuff. And it's just used for Twitter. And so then you can make your comment, you know, you got your 160, 140 characters, whatever, to say your thing. And then it includes a link in the tweet. And then it creates a picture of that text that you grabbed. And you can kind of edit the size of the picture down, including your highlight, along with the title and the link and the author, all in this picture, which it then appends to your tweet. And so it's this really cool, like, way of adding a summary. Someone can read the entire article, but you're highlighting the part that you found most interesting.
Right.
Does that make sense? It's a super cool app. I use it fairly regularly on Twitter, James Furlow. To me, it's like, okay, but how do you take that even a step further, potentially?
Right.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like that's an interesting idea. I'm kind of glad you're coming around to the idea. We need shorter clips. We need both. Because I also do enjoy this.
But... I would say this for me, but you know, it'd be nice for our users. I'll be like, you guys talk forever.
Yeah,
it's because we're really interesting guys.
Because I read an article that I'm not linking to, so deal with it, that was talking about podcasting and Can It Save the World, and it was essentially talking about all the benefits and how amazing it is, and their takeaway was like 20 minutes max, guys, 20 minutes max.
Yeah.
I'm like, whatever, dude. All the podcasts I listen to are more than...
I know.
Okay, there's one that... Or that's not true. I've got like three, I guess, that are... No, I've got two. Really,
you can do this, James. 20 to 30 minutes. Yeah, I don't listen. I actually don't. I tend to not like podcasts that are 20-minute podcasts. I don't know why, but I'm subscribed to a couple of them, and I just can't get into it like regularly. Those aren't the ones I go back to.
Well, the problems are like usually they're which you'd think we would follow suit here, but the interview ones are always super interesting.
Yeah.
But it's like you cannot get in the meat of an issue in 20 minutes.
Nope.
I've listened to those. They're garbage. Yep. You scratch the surface and you're like, ah, this left me wanting more. Or the only way you can get away with that is if you did an interview and then you piece it all together yourself and turn it into an article. And essentially you're reading that.
Yeah.
Article.
And it's funny cause I listened to S Town, which is brought to you by one of the producers of This American Life. And, it's fantastic, but he took like, it was like multiple years worth of research and talking with people and interviews that was edited down into an 8-part podcast, which each episode's an hour. I mean, like, it's just a lot of content, but like you said, it was all hyper edited. I also listened to a couple of,
is that the guy who had a kid and didn't want anyone to know about it?
No. This is about a dude who was a clock repair guy in Alabama. It's good. It's salty language, but it's super somber. Holy cow! But it's good. And they, what was I going to say? I listen to basically a 2-hour radio show every day in podcast form, and then a couple of 2-hour weekly radio shows that are podcasts. Like, I listen to long podcasts. That's what I like, for the exact reason that you said. Like, sometimes it just takes longer to get into the topic and to, like, to really, like, you build these hours long narrative based on a couple of moving targets and stuff. I don't know. We probably delved into this stuff for our audience's attention, but I think it's just interesting how this tech, like, how does it evolve? How does it, you know, how do you build something like this? I think it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you, and we'll loop it all the way back to the idiotic Internet of Things, where it's like, yeah, it feels like that scratches the surface of something potentially greater,
right?
And how do you create tools to enable audio sound bites, if you will,
right?
Similar to like that one shot, but in an audio version. And would anybody ever be interested in a complete thought that's 5 minutes? Because that's the other thought that I had, and it was talking about this podcasting saving the world thing and it being on demand. I was like, you know, the cool part about like aggregators is you just get the title and you can skim it real quick, and it, you know, and it pulls from a bunch of different sources. Like, that does not exist in the podcast world.
Right.
You just subscribe to channels. It's more, I don't even know. I mean, it's not like Netflix. It's, I'm really struggling to even figure out, like, what's that? Is it like a TV where you have a set of channels? It's an RSS feeder, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. It's an audio. There we go. It's an audio version of your RSS reader, which is great for a certain set of people. But for the mass majority, it's like, well, I want to kill some time on a run. I just want to listen to something.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe just real quickly, let me grab it and then go, next, you know, or somehow like YouTube, right? It tells you, here's the ones we think are best for you. But then you also have your channels that you subscribe to, and based on what you listen to or watch, we think you'll really enjoy these. And somehow, like, there needs to be a podcast version of that, but also somehow just works with audio, because it's obviously an audio format. You don't want people to be looking at a screen. It's almost like, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either, James. I don't.
Oh, there's something there, though.
Yep. I feel it. I'm excited.
All right. We got to move on, because yeah, we're hitting the wall here. And we got four more articles.
Speaking of things that are too long. So I'm going to fly through both of mine really quick. Just bang, bang.
Okay.
So number one, Boeing is 3D printing parts for their planes out of titanium. Yeah. Okay. So to me, the cool part is just, this is not shocking this would happen, but the reason why they're doing it is because it's going to save $3 million per plane, which is interesting. And
that's significant.
We are racing towards a world where additive manufacturing is just going to change everything. It's cool. It's exciting. Get on board. Everybody who, like, it's a big deal, especially these metal printers that can print a titanium. And then the other thing is, it was fascinating to me that a couple of months ago, we were talking about Leico as like, they were the future, like they were growing big time. They're going gangbusters. And like, there was article, we went through this phase, like there was a bunch of articles written in like a month long period where they're like, Leico, man, this is a monster company. They're growing super fast. They're taking over everything. They bought Vizio. They were doing gangbusters in China. And then like the next week, they're like, we're out of money. And it's gotten so bad that the Vizio deal has fallen apart. They're no longer, Vizio's been staying an independent company. it's pretty amazing. So Leico, they were hot stuff for a minute. but
that happens. Yep. So. Okay. I've made a decision on the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai.
Okay.
P-A-I. He's been making some decisions, which I think most of us would call borderline questionable. And You know, he's what he's done two of them so far, where it was like the privacy thing with the ISPs. Like, I forget that.
Yeah.
What was he did another one? You know, he's kind of like a non net neutrality kind of guy, which hasn't done anything there. But we're like, oh man, it's coming down the pipe. And then, oh my gosh, there was one other one, and I can't think of it right now. But it's always been his like his one liner or his like whatever his philosophy, his stance has been like, well, regulation is bad, which is why net neutrality is technically a regulation. He's like, no, we want to get rid of that. And the privacy stuff was regulation. And he's like, no, we want to get rid of that and whatever. And I disagreed with most of them, but I also, I understood his philosophy, you know, and was like, okay, I don't agree, but at least he's consistent, fine, whatever. And we're just going to have to deal with this. And, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I take it back. The dude is just kind of selfish and just kind of like, what does his constituents want? What does he think is like, what does he personally think is best versus, or what does he want? Maybe is even a better way to say it versus this is what I think is the best thing for the Americans.
Yeah.
And here's why I say that, because he has come out this week and he picked a really good week to do it. I'll give him that to say, we are going to keep the ban on phone calls on all planes. We are going to keep that regulation and not allow it because he quote, I don't like it when I don't even like the idea of people making phone calls on a plane. I like my peace and quiet during plane ride.
Yep.
So we're going to keep the ban, which I'm like, that breaks down all your other arguments now. This whole, like, keep it free and no regulation, and now you're okay with, like, I fully expected him to be like, no, we'll let the planes decide. Which, again, it was like, so with the ISP thing, right, everyone was like, oh my gosh, there goes our whatever. And, you know, they looked into it, and, like, they're like, no, no companies planning on doing anything with this. It's okay.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's really not that big of a deal. Which, it was interesting, there are international carriers that do allow phone calls on flights. And like one of them, I don't even remember which it was. It's Aerial Mobile Communications. They've been around since 2008. They're like 5% of passengers on flights bound for the US make calls, and they last on average 2 minutes. In other words, not a big deal.
Right.
But I fully would have expected him to say, we will let the airplanes, the airlines decide.
Like,
which, interestingly, Wi-Fi calls, that's a different ballgame.
Yeah.
Like, you could do a Skype phone call. That's allowed.
Yeah. And I, like, I tend to, it's funny because I tend to agree with this decision, but I agree with you in that I don't like the fact that it's just inconsistent. And there isn't this overriding ethos. It's like, no, we're gonna, well, what it tends to show you is that he probably does have a consistent ethos, and it is one that what benefit, like you said, it's what benefits me personally. What's most likely to, as a guy who is the chair of the FCC, who can go and get a job at the telecoms after his stint at the FCC.
Yeah.
You know, what's going to benefit me most? Well, this is my industry. Getting a job at one of these companies as a former FCC chairman would benefit me most financially. So I'll help them out. And which is always the big complaint of crony capitalism, no matter what political aisle it comes from. And it's super frustrating because it's like you said, it doesn't actually directly benefit us. And phone calls on a plane isn't big enough business for the telecoms to come in and say, no, we want, don't do this. Like, and like you said, it's an FCC regulate. It's a thing that affects the planes more than it affects the telecoms. So because it doesn't help the telecoms, no, we'll keep that regulation in place. Like, just be consistent, man. Like, do it whether it helps you or not. That's all I really want. You know, obviously, do what you think is, you know, your job is to do what you think is best, but have a consistent ethos so that we've got something we can expect and don't just make money from it. But whatever.
Yeah, just frustrating. And then finally, so I don't know if you pay attention to Facebook's app updates. they are not small.
Nope.
They're on version 87 right now. And somehow their app has grown 88 megabytes. It's like up to like 253 megabytes right now.
Yeah, it's gigantic.
It's ridiculous. You know, the joke is like Apple ended up dropping the 16 gigabyte iPhone just to make room for Facebook. And it's pretty crazy. Apparently like some people took it apart. They've like 40 megabytes of our resources are just duplicated.
There are some design ethos at Facebook that results in this. And it's a real issue. It's actually a huge issue for them. It's a huge issue for the Instagram team, because they have to keep their code base consistent with Facebook code base. And there is all sorts of liabilities that go along with that. And they're just like, our app, like there are features that they've not been able to push out in a timely manner because they couldn't figure out how to keep it small enough to keep it consistent. Like I've talked with guys like inside that work on these, and they're just like, yeah, it's a huge mess. They duplicate classes and they build single function classes, which a little bit into the coding weeds, but that's a ridiculous idea. Like there was a while there where it kind of made sense. Like the number of classes that your program had was sort of a testament to how it was a quick and dirty way to say how complicated and powerful your program is. It was sort of like how many lines of code is your application, you know, because a lot of lines of codes means, oh, it's a giant program that took a really long time to write. And it's very complicated. Very few lines of code is a testament to something that was really efficient or whatever. But maybe less complicated. And Facebook, they kind of went that way with classes, which just resulted in an enormous amount of duplicated code or a redundant code, superfluous code. But what was even worse was that it was it's so gigantic that they've started to duplicate functions because they literally like you'll have one feature that's supposed to do this one small thing, like format text this way. And you can't find it in their code base, so you just rewrite it and build your own, which is like that's wow. It just becomes ridiculous. And yeah, it's a monolithic monster. And the worst part is that it's all Objective-C, so it's the code base that Apple is trying to move away from. But it's such a monstrosity that they can't jump over to Swift. They have no desire to. They're not even looking at how would we do that. They only hire Objective-C programmers because they've got no, like, you know, and you know, for many years made sense because they're like, well, it wasn't a stable, you know, we're the biggest app on earth. We're going to stick with the stable platform. Thank you very much. But the frustrating part about that is like, well, yeah, that totally makes sense, except a lot of your competitors have started to do big chunks of their app in Swift, and it works fantastically. So for them at this point, it's just it would be such a monster to try to port that they don't.
Yeah, I think one of the other jokes was they were like, you know, probably like 50 megabytes of it is every single story that their users have submitted on Facebook. just have it quickly loaded. Yeah. Pretty bad, which was the Instagram. Is it really getting used? Or that would be more like the Messenger. Just nobody. I think I've seen like two.
Yeah.
And they are annoying when I see them. Which one of them, it was great. It was for a guy, you could tell he did not intend for it to be sent to the world. He had sent it to a specific person and did not realize that it was being shared with everybody.
What?
Which was awesome. Which makes sense because Messenger is designed for two specific people conversations, right? Not broadcast to the world. Awesome use. But yeah, anyways, Facebook app. It's ginormous. Yeah. fun times. All right. That's what we got. Thanks for listening. Super good. Happy Easters. And hope you had some good time hanging out with your family. And don't forget, you can check out all the show notes and all the links at furloughbros.com. This is episode 290, 10 away from 300. That's absolutely crazy. If you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you, you can sign up at the same page on the right-hand side. And finally, this podcast is supported by listeners like you. If you'd also like to contribute, we have 4 different levels. We got fanboys, nerds, junkies, and mavens, which each have their own different levels of reward. And again, you can check out furloughbros.com to figure out how you too can become a patron. All right. Let's see here. With that, I am James Furlough, and my pastel but fast driving brother is Matthew Furlough, and so we will talk next time. Thank you.